Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Mike Shackelford. My co-host, Bob Dancer, is enjoying a cruise as we speak, so I will be doing the show by myself tonight. I'm envious of Bob on his cruise. I have won four cruises since I moved to Las Vegas and gone on zero of them because cruises and having children don't go together very well because they always schedule these cruises during the school year. And I don't think my wife would let me go by myself. Planned for the show today is a pre-recorded interview with former co-host Richard Munchkin. Before we get to that, let's talk about gambling in the news. It's all over the forums and the newspaper today that in Atlantic City, the Golden Nugget is involved in a scandal involving dealing baccarat with unshuffled cards. And if this sounds familiar, earlier this summer, the exact same thing happened at the Trump Plaza in Atlantic City. At the Trump, they got a $400,000 fine from the Gaming Control Board in Atlantic City for using unshuffled cards, and they lost $91,236 to players who figured it out before they did. Deja vu, the same thing happens now at the Golden Nugget. In case you didn't know, casinos normally or often buy pre-shuffled cards directly from the manufacturer. In this case, the Golden Nugget in Atlantic City, not the one here, bought them this way from Gemico. And they put them in the shoe and started dealing cards. And little did they know, evidently, that they were not shuffled. They were in order. And I presume they were in the same kind of order when you buy cards, where first 13 of one suit comes out all sequentially and then 13 of another suit. And this game went on for 2.5 hours. And the players, again, figured it out. The dealer, the floorman, security, never understood, evidently, why these players were winning so much money. And as soon as the players figured it out that the cards were unshuffled, immediately minimum bet players jumped up to maximum bet players. How many red flags were thrown off by all this, and the Golden Nugget let the game go on. And I understand they watched it very carefully, trying to figure out why these players won 41 consecutive hands, but they didn't figure it out. And eventually, I guess the end of the shoe was reached. And later that evening, as I understand the story, they handcuffed some of the players. I hear that they barged into their rooms at night. I don't know all the details, but there are charges that the players were illegally detained on accusation of cheating. So now the Golden Nugget not only has this big loss, which, by the way, was $1,536,700, but I think they should also get the same $400,000 fine from the Gaming Control Board in Atlantic City, and they might be looking at an unlawful detainment lawsuit by some of the players. There is some chatter on my forum that maybe this was an inside job. I don't rule that out, but I certainly think the players have a reasonable doubt that they just figured it out naturally and the cards were just not shuffled. I am beside myself wondering, how could a whole casino not figure this out? And I just don't know what to say. I am perplexed. Maybe there's more to the story, but this is pretty much all that's known by the public for now. And we will keep you up to date. Another big story in Vegas news, having nothing to do with gambling, is Prince Harry's visit. Evidently, he was staying at the Wynn in a fancy suite that had a pool table. At first, he was partying it up in the swimming pool, and I hear he challenged a Olympic swimmer to a swimming race. And later, I guess Harry and his friends got a little bored, and they went down to the bar, and they invited a bunch of girls up to their suite. And they played a game of strip pool. And after that, things just got very, I don't know, a big party ensued where nobody was wearing anything, and some pictures were taken. Personally, I say to Prince Harry, bravo. I wish that was me. When I was young, things like that never happened to me. So, you know, of course, I think the odds are a little in his favor being a handsome young prince. But still, I say if you have the opportunity, seize it. Does it embarrass the crown? You know, I don't really care. It seems like the only time you ever hear about the English royalty doing anything other than weddings, births, and deaths is when there's some kind of a scandal. So, you know, maybe he was providing some entertainment there. At least I found it very entertaining, and I think others did too. So good for you, Harry. Let's get on with the interview. This interview was pre-recorded earlier this summer of co-host Richard Munchkin. And Lawrence, let's play it.
Richard Munchkin was a co-host for this show for 6 months and remains an ardent supporter. He continues to be involved behind the scenes. He's been an advantage gambler for almost 40 years and has an interesting perspective. I always learn something new when I talk to Munchkin. Richard Munchkin, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Happy to be back. Not 40 years, by the way. I'm not quite that old. But
how long have you been an advantage gambler?
Well, actually, if you count, you know, playing, I guess I was playing with an advantage even when I was a teenager. So maybe 40 years is right, you know, because I did play poker and backgammon with an edge before I got out to the casinos.
Yeah, and we did say almost. So that means...
Okay, I'll buy it.
And you're older than you think. One of the websites I regularly visit for Gambling Perspective is richardmunchkin.com. Tonight, we want to talk about something Munch posted there on July 1st, 2012. He gave a link to the This American Life radio archives on a show that dealt with blackjack. Now, I'd never heard of these archives before, so that in and of itself was useful information for me. On the second segment of that show, it dealt with a conservative Christian blackjack team called the Holy Rollers. We're attempting to get one of them on the show at a later date, and I'm pretty sure we'll be able to get that, but today is not really about them. That said, a few different items on that radio segment about them are worth exploring. The first has to do with team members stealing from each other. So Munch, first, please tell us about the specifics of the incident on that radio, and then we'll take it from there.
So, on that program, one of the members of the team revealed that at one point he had stolen from his teammates and later went back and told them that he had stolen from them.
And how did the team members react when he said that?
He doesn't go into a lot of detail about how they reacted, but he does talk about the fact that they were his best friends, these people that he had to go back to and reveal this to. And this is a real rarity. I don't think I ever heard of another case of a team member going back to his team and saying, I stole this money and I owe you and here it is.
And they're stealing. There was sort of some special circumstances around this one, though.
Well, that's one of the things I found really interesting, because in his case, what happened was his car was broken into and $8,000 was stolen out of his car. And rather than tell his team and replace the $8,000, he just counted it as if he had lost it in a casino. Now, on teams that I've been on, I think many of the teams that I've played with would have considered that a loss to the team, not to the individual. But that's part of why it's really important to try to spell out every possible thing that can go wrong on a team at the beginning, so that these kind of questions are answered. Whose responsibility is that?
So if somebody were at fault, say...
Well, okay, so I was on a team where we had a big player who, after a play, he got drunk.
Yeah.
And I believe it was the same amount of money. It was either $7,000 or $8,000 he claimed fell out of his pocket in a taxi cab on his way home. I mean, he was smart enough to know he was too drunk to drive, so he took a cab, and he ended up $7,000 or $8,000 short. Now, in that case, the team, decided... this was his responsibility. He should be responsible for that money and pay it back to the team. But now we had another situation back before computers were illegal.
Yeah.
We had communication equipment built into our shoes.
Yeah.
And one of the team members had all of our equipment in the back of his SUV and was driving from Lake Tahoe down here to Vegas and stopped somewhere for lunch, and someone broke into his car and stole all our electronic equipment.
And this is $3,000, $5,000?
Yes, something like that.
Uh-huh. How did you guys handle it?
Well, coincidentally, this was right about July 85 when the law was changing. So as it turned out, we really could no longer use the equipment anyway. But I'm sure that if we still wanted to use the equipment and had to have it made again, I'm sure we would have looked at it as a team expense, not as his. He wasn't negligent. You know, he had locked his car. Just
usually isn't the situation where if it's the person's fault for losing the money, then it's on him. But if it's an act of crime or it's an act of God, then it's a team loss.
Yeah, that's certainly the way we would normally handle it. I mean, I don't think we ever spelled it out in that way at the beginning, but maybe we did say if you lose money through your own negligence, then yes, it's your responsibility.
And there can be gray areas.
Definitely with
now,
negligence.
Now, you know, here's another thing that happened.
Uh-huh.
I had a teammate who was in Los Angeles and was staying at a hotel where they had safe deposit boxes.
Yes.
And he was leaving the hotel, but he asked if he could keep his safe deposit box. And he actually called us and said, should I take the money, or I think it's safer if I leave it here in the hotel in the safe deposit box? And we said, yeah, leave it in the safe deposit box. Well, the safe deposit box was broken into and the money was stolen.
He certainly was not negligent.
I mean, he was not negligent, but... you know, and there was a case where he called and asked what to do. So
now, how often do you think gambling team members rip off their own team?
I think it happens a lot, especially with big teams. I think it happens often, and there are other things that happen that are also not quite stealing, but in a way costing the other team members money. One of them is... players who basically are afraid of heat, so they play bad conditions, crowded tables, tables with bad penetration, so they can sort of hide and not have to bet the money that they should be betting.
So they get the hours in, but they're not really getting value.
Exactly, and on teams I've played on, the money is divided by the number of hours you play. So if they're putting in hours at bad games just to rack up hours, I mean, you're kind of stealing from your teammates.
Definitely.
But I think actual skimming goes on quite often, too.
But doesn't the skimming pretty much ruin the effectiveness of the whole team? Because it just takes a little skimming to ruin everything.
Yeah, yeah, it can. And there are, you know, I know of quite a few teams who've broken up over that kind of thing, where they suspected the skimming was going on, the results were not what they should have been, and, you know, and yeah, it does ruin everything.
Yeah, if I had to do it over again, I would be a lot more picky about people that I chose to trust in the world of gambling.
You know, over the years, what I like to say now is that I play not with a team, but with partners. I no longer play with a large group of people. I play with very few, and I look at them as partners, and our partnership lasts basically over a weekend or however long we're playing, but we don't have an ongoing bankroll where we're trying to win a certain amount of money. We go somewhere for 3 or 4 days, we play, at the end of the 3 or 4 days, we cut up the money evenly, win or lose, you know, it's all equal and it's done. But yeah, I've found a few people that I can really trust, and I, you know, I don't have.
So some you're not going to be partners with again, and some you would welcome the opportunity.
That's exactly right. Let me tell you another story. We had a BP in
big player,
a big player up in. We were in Lake Tahoe, South Shore. So he was Japanese, and we were in Caesars.
Probably still is.
He still is. Yeah. And we were in Caesars, and we gave him the $20,000. We told him, okay, you're going to meet this player over at Harrah's next door. You know, he'll be in this pit. You know, just go there. He knew all the signals, right? He leaves. He never shows up on the game. Gone. Just gone. Not in the hotel. Gone. And we finally got a hold of him a week later. And, I mean, basically, he just walked away with our $20,000 is what had happened. But, you know, his story was that he got mugged between Caesars and Harrah's. and he was so ashamed that he couldn't face us, so he just went directly to the airport and flew home.
That didn't pass the smell test?
No. But what do you do? What can you do?
Well, that's the question. What do you do?
Well, I mean, we're not mobsters. I mean, we're not going to go threaten to break his legs or anything. I mean, basically, we had to write it off. It was a loss.
So what do good teams do when they suspect cheating, but they're not absolutely sure?
Well, basically, they just sever the partnership with that player. I mean, at times, I've been involved with teams that have done polygraphs, but everyone knows polygraphs are really useless. They don't work, and you know, a little bit of time on the internet and you can learn how to beat a polygraph. So, yeah, I mean, they're kind of useless. So most of the people I know nowadays just say, hey, maybe you're unlucky, maybe you're not playing well, for whatever reason, we're going our separate ways. Now, I know of one case where a guy suspected this was going on, and he wanted to be 100% conclusively sure. And, you know, he came up with a method of audio recording every single bet that had happened at the table during the course of the play. And he did it numerous times, and every single time some skimming had happened. And but he could never be 100% sure. He thought he might have missed one of the bets, or he might have garbled something on the recorder. But eventually he got one that was completely clean, 100%. And again, and the rest of us were all saying, hey, you know, it's happened 12 times and you think you might have made a mistake, you know, each time. But still, you know, it's enough for me, you know.
Cost you $20,000 to be sure.
Yeah, or more. Yeah, it cost a lot of money to be sure.
I was an investor on a big team, and in 2 years, the team lost money. And at one time, everyone was polygraphed, and the results were, quote unquote, inconclusive.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, but now, you know, I can tell you how bad this can go.
How bad can this go?
Well, I had some friends who were young and stupid back many years ago. And they had a teammate that they were sure had stolen $40,000. And basically, they took him to a hotel room and they would not let him leave and said, you know, we know you stole this money, you know. And eventually, the guy admitted, okay, yes, I stole the money. And they were like, well, you have to pay us back. And he said, okay, I'll go get the money and give it back to you. And he left and immediately went to the police and said, I've been detained by these guys and held against my will. And they were arrested for kidnapping. And eventually it got pled down, but they had to do 5 days in jail in Lake Tahoe over this. And that was lucky. I mean, they could have ended up with a felony kidnapping charge on their hands, you know. So you don't want to decide you're, you know, macho guys and, you know, you don't, you know. Obviously, they made a big mistake and they paid for it.
When somebody loses money on your team or is confiscated by the police or something like that, and then it's a team expense to try to get it back, can you usually get it back if it's confiscated by the police?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think I know of any cases where they haven't gotten it back. And usually it costs you between $5,000 and $10,000 in lawyer's fees. But everybody I know has gotten their money back. Now, sometimes the casino steals the money. There's a problem with one of the Indian casinos in Michigan where the casino stole the money, and that they haven't gotten back.
Because the players were hole carding, and the casinos considered that cheating?
Is
that the case we're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. It was a tribal court, and, you know, they don't have to pay attention to U.S. laws, and they decided they were just going to keep the money. And actually, I think they are still working on getting the money back, but so far, as far as I know, they haven't gotten it back yet.
Are there any tests you can use to detect cheating on a team?
Well, certainly being a math guy, you should be able to look at people's, records and not just, how much they've lost compared to, you know, what their edge was, but also, aren't there ways to determine, like, if they're making up numbers, they have to make them up in
Yes.
Certain random sort of way. So I guess there are statistically ways to determine it, but in the cases that I've been familiar with, it's always just been, you know, I don't know for sure, but I'd rather just not play with the guy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Before it ever gets to that point.
Yeah, it's number one. Human beings are terrible at picking random numbers. Like, if I ask you to pick a random number from 1 to 10 right now, what would you
Three.
Pick? Okay. And I tend to think that you are being a contrarian because most people pick 7.
Yeah, I've been a magician, so I know most people pick 7. So you're right.
But that's also a way you can determine voter fraud, is if you see election results come back and you just study like the last 3 digits, and you should expect to see somewhat of a uniform distribution with some variance. But usually people will pick the same sequences over and over. But if I were, I think a smart cheater would probably only skim if he were winning. And if he were doing really badly, he would probably not want to draw more attention to himself by skimming off a bad result.
I think that's probably true.
Which makes it all the more difficult to detect.
Right.
So let's get off the cheating subject for a while. There's another thing talked about on that same radio show about players by themselves in a big luxurious suite, Caesar's Palace, overlooking the Las Vegas Strip, and they're just sitting there alone by themselves, not interested in all this luxury and the mirrors on the ceiling and all this kind of thing. So it took many, many years to get good enough so the casinos give you all these things, and then when you get them, some people go, is this all there is? Do you know people who were burned out by this?
Oh God, yeah. And those are the better situations, you know. I mean, what about when you're in Motel 6 in the middle of Iowa, you know, in the winter, and, you know, I mean, it can be awful. I mean, and I do not envy these, there are a few card counters out there that just basically live out of a suitcase, and I guess they like that solitary life, but personally, I hate it. I would rather go play a $200 an hour game with a partner than a $500 an hour game by myself, you know, just because I've learned over the years that that's what makes me happy, and I would rather be with other people than by myself.
A lot of listeners to this program would like to know about a $200 an hour game under any conditions.
Well, I think a lot of listeners to this show are playing $200 an hour games. I would hope so. If not, you should go listen to more of these episodes.
Yes, sometimes I would like to find a $200 an hour game. And so, yes, I have them on occasion, but not on a regular basis. Now, on a similar basis, similar vein maybe, some advantage gamblers require subterfuge. You're pretending to be something that you're not. And some players, even though they get really good, they find that they would rather be honest people and be able to talk about their profession and be able to have a normal kind of life. And they hate the subterfuge. Me, I kind of enjoy the subterfuge. But
yeah, I mean, I think there are two parts to that. One is lying in the casino to the casino employees. And then the other is when you're outside in your normal life. So, like, when I was single, I found it to be very difficult. Like, it was very hard to meet women because sometimes you'd meet them in the casino. They'd know you by a name that was not your name. And, you know, while you're in the casino, you've made up some story about what you do for a living. So, I found that part of it difficult. I found it difficult to do that in my personal life as opposed to in the casino. Yeah, I could tell them anything. That doesn't bother me, you know. But, in my personal life, you know, when my kids were little and in school and I was there with the soccer moms and they asked me what I do for a living, you know, well, I would tell them I'm a writer and, you know, I really wouldn't get into it. Now I don't care because my kids are older. I just was afraid it may have some kind of, you know, problem for my kids in school or something like that. But,
and now you don't care what soccer moms think of you.
Yeah, now it's kind of fun, you know, to tell them, oh, I gamble. And if you don't live in Las Vegas, that's kind of a, you know, a big deal, a big topic of a conversation. It's a good conversation starter at a party, you know, if you don't live in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Okay, change of topic. Bovada, formerly known as Bodog, recently introduced a rule in their poker room where everyone is anonymous. So it's going to be player one, player two, player three. So there's no more playing against a face. You're playing against people who you have no idea who they are. Now, I'm sure that the good players didn't like this and the bad ones did. But what have you been hearing in the poker world about that?
Well, I think it's a great thing. I think it's really good for poker. But the other thing is, when you had access to all the hand histories, to me, you're playing a completely different game. You're not playing poker anymore. You're analyzing statistics. And there are edges to be found at that. You know, I mean, it's a way of making money, but it wasn't really poker. And I'm curious how those players would do. The guys who really relied on looking at the hand histories, I'm curious how they would do in live games where they actually had to play poker again. You know, but, you know, 95% of the players didn't use that information. And if they were playing against players who did, they just got wiped out very quickly. You know, and so I think it's great. I mean, I don't think we owe those guys a living, the guys who knew how to use the statistics. So like any other gambler, they have to adapt as things change. But it's definitely much better for the game of poker to take that away.
But even so, it's less translatable into the brick and mortar game. So if you assume all people are normal, you're not really in a tournament. You don't have time to determine whether somebody's tight aggressive or loose aggressive or those kind of things.
You pick those things up, but you don't know. You don't know. I mean, what these guys were doing was they could look at your hand history and say, you know, this guy calls 11% of the time before the flop. You know, and so if you're in the hand, they can narrow your range of hands to X. You know what I mean? So, but now they go to a live game, they have no idea how, you know, how often you call before the flop. So, yeah, I don't think they will make the transition to live games very well, the guys who are playing, you know, using those kind of stats.
But even the players now who can't use those stats, I mean, because nobody can. If you're used to playing against number one and number seven and number three, and number three today is different than number three yesterday.
Yeah, you start over every time.
You start over every time, whereas in brick and mortar, you see the same people every day.
Okay, if you're a regular player, yeah. But if I go into one of the casinos and sit at the poker table, I don't know any of those people, so I'm starting from scratch, you know. But yeah, if you play in a regular game every day with the same players, then yeah, you'll eventually acquire those, not the exact stats, but your own version of them.
Good.
So this interview is being pre-recorded, and we recently had on the show Arnold Snyder, and I take it you listened to his shows.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments about them?
You know, I thought his books were really good. He of course got a lot of flack from the mainstream poker community. I guess because he wasn't a frequenter of 2+2, or maybe they thought his theories were a little odd. But I thought his books were really good and really readable. I mean, Arnold's a really good writer. So
yes.
You know, even if I haven't read his Sudoku books, but I'll bet they're very readable.
are readable. And next time I have him on the air, I'm going to correct him on a few things on Sudoku. But okay. Michael and I can't agree. Like, I always pronounce it Sudoku, and last time we talked to Arnold about it, he pronounced it differently. And so then I try to pronounce it the way Arnold pronounced it. And then Michael has his own
Sudoku.
Way. And who knows?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. But no, anyway, I liked his books. I thought they were very valuable. Again, they're written for a very specific thing, you know, for these short tournaments, these fast tournaments.
His first book was written for fast tournaments. His second book was written for slower tournaments.
Ah, okay. I guess the first one had more of an impact on me than the second one. But I don't know. I should go back and reread him. And, you know, he certainly was successful. I mean,
he was. And in the 2012, he did compete in at least one of the events of the World Series. He competed in the senior event, and he didn't do particularly well. And his comment to Mike and me afterwards was, he probably should have gone back and read his books before he competed in the tournament.
Cause you know, poker, like any game, is one of those things that you have to play. The more you play, the better you're going to be. You know, so if you haven't played in a long time, then you know I wouldn't expect him to play well at any game, right? Backgammon or whatever. You're just, you know, you have to play a lot to be good.
Now, fairly recently, there was a story out of Atlantic City about Baccarat, where there might have been a shoe that didn't get reshuffled, or...
Well, the casino was fined, so I guess they were able to look at the tape and find that the shoe was not shuffled.
So why would a casino not do this unless the dealer was on a take? And did it seem like this was a dealer on the take, and were players able to exploit it?
You know, I would love to have more details about this story, because my initial thought was, yeah, the dealer didn't shuffle the shoe, but if that were true, then these were the worst cheats in the history of, I mean, the two thing, one thing kind of tipped off the casino that something was wrong, and that was that it took 3.5 or 4 hours to go through this one Baccarat shoe.
Well, usually it should take about 1 hour.
Yeah, exactly. And the players only won, as I recall, $40,000 or $50,000. Now, if you had an unshuffled Baccarat shoe and you knew it and you had the information, you know, you should win $1 million. So... if they're cheats, they're really bad at it. There are a lot of things that are just odd about this story. And why would it take 3.5 or 4 hours? I mean, the fact that it took 3.5 or 4 hours leads me to believe that the players were trying to reconstruct things from the prior shoe. So maybe they had some information written down, but not all of what they needed, and they had to figure it out. I don't know.
This sounds to me like it might have been accidental.
Yeah.
Because if I had a dealer that was going to do this deliberately, I would have figured out exactly how to take advantage of the situation beforehand.
In the book, The Man with the $100,000 Breasts, yes. they tell the story about the computer cooler, where they did yes. this on a blackjack game.
Yes.
And there, you know, they recorded every card in order and, you know, had a computer program that told you exactly how many hands to play and all that. And, you know, so yeah, if you're a sophisticated cheating crew, you're going to win $1 million with this. But yeah, if it happened accidentally and you had some kind of notes like, you know, the dealer, this hand, the dealer won with 8/6 or whatever, the banker won with 8/6, and you were trying to reconstruct, you know, things and maybe get an edge that way. I don't know. I'd love to know more about the story.
Yeah, the first time I heard it, it would seem like, well, if it's in the same order and people recorded in baccarat, they do it all the time, that the banker won 3 or 4 hands in a row and then the player won and then there was a tie. But the order in the unshuffled shoe would be different.
Right.
Because when they're coming out, it would be banker, player, banker, player. But when they're sweeping them up, all the bankers are together and all the players are together. So it is not does not look the same as it did last time. You have to transcribe it.
Right, right.
Bob, I recall from your book, before you were a video poker player, you were a blackjack counter. And at the Stratosphere, you played at a game where there was some cheating going on, but you were not privy to it.
Yes.
Do you remember that story?
I do.
Time?
Sure. We have a few minutes. I sat down at a blackjack table apparently 3 minutes before a big deal was going to go down. The dealer had been contacted by gamblers and was going to put in a prearranged shoe. And then these gamblers were going to take up the whole table and bet a bunch.
They must not have been happy to have you sit down.
Well, and so the dealer agrees, and he goes to Bob Stupak afterwards, after he was contacted, but before, and said, I've been approached on this. I told him I'm going to think about it. What should I do? And so Stupak says, well, say yes, and we'll have this place crawling with police and sheriffs and what Griffin or whatever. And plus, Stupak at that time had a sky view where his apartment was on the second floor, and so he had this mirror right overlooking the blackjack pit. So he made it do it on the one right underneath him so he could have the best view for doing this. With this bus going on, and I don't know if he had his girlfriend there and was going to use this as foreplay, if this is going to be pretty exciting and whatever. But anyway, 5 minutes before it was supposed to go down, I sat down at the table accidentally. I was on a promotion. It was one of my first times in Vegas, and the dealer kept telling me that what a great gourmet room they had there, and I was on a program where I was playing, I think, quarter chips for 4 hours, and they gave me something. I was brand new to the blackjack world at that point, and this was a program they had authorized. He kept trying to get me to go to the gourmet room, and they kept suggesting and telling me how good. And I go, oh, no, I'm fine here. I got to play 4 hours, and I'm winning. And so apparently an hour later, I decided, all right, why don't you give me the comp to the room, to the gourmet room, and I went off to my dinner. And 5 minutes later, the shoe came in, and it was over. Apparently in 3 minutes. The next day in the RJ, I was mentioned that the first time I ever met the mentioned in the RJ that there's this high roller gambler. and that was the whole thing. And I kind of liked that phrase because at that time betting $25 for 4 hours straight was really big betting for me. But anyway, that was my story way back when. So this is supposed to be Munchkin's interview. And we used it up talking about my blackjack days.
Oh, hey, at least you didn't get arrested and swept up with the bad guys.
No, well, there's a lot of guns. I the police had guns, and I don't know if the gamblers did or not, but I could have gotten in the crossfire kind of easily. Anyway, thank you very much for being on the show, Munchkin.
Happy to do it.
Yeah, thanks much. Okay, so that was an interview of Richard Munchkin, pre-recorded earlier this summer. For those of you who may have joined us late, Bob Dancer is on a cruise right now, so I'm doing the show by myself. I forgot that we asked Munch, or that he talked about the first scandal in Atlantic City involving unshuffled cards. And I guess Munch kind of corrected something that I said earlier in the show, is that when this happened at the Trump, they didn't use completely unshuffled cards, but they played a shoe. And normally in mini baccarat, you would shuffle the cards and then deal the cards again. But evidently at the Trump Plaza, or maybe it was the Taj Mahal, I'm not sure, they didn't shuffle them and just used the same cards again. Now, why it took the players so long to get through the shoe, I presume it's maybe because they didn't put on paper what happened. And maybe between the players, they had to try to recollect from the best of their memory. Well, what happened next? Was it a banker player tie? And maybe that's why it took them so long. I don't really know. But Munch, thanks for doing that interview. With the rest of our time, let me get the commercials out of the way so I can pace myself a little better. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. That is more than anybody else. Every day in August at 9:20 p.m., 10 names are drawn in the $1 Million August Cash Blast. First prize is $10,000 or $25,000 if you're there within 10 minutes, and the other 9 winners get $1,000. Maximum tickets are earned by playing $1,000 coin in. This is a day-by-day drawing, and all entries are discarded after the drawing. There is a senior slot tournament with the first entry free, and you can earn 2 more entries with a modest amount of play. Bob's next free seminar video poker classes will begin in a month on September 18th on Tuesdays at noon. The first class is Jacks or Better. The Palms. Weekly drawings take place Friday and Saturday evenings. 10 players earn cash. The first 5 names called win cash, averaging $1,100 each, and places 6 to 10 win cash, averaging $275 apiece. For the rest of the month, the Play, Earn, and Win promotion allows you to earn free play at a rate of 0.25% every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, up to a maximum of $88,000 coin in per day. This is equivalent to double points. On Thursday, seniors can swipe and win up to $500 in free play or a Kindle Fire. 3 days a week, you get approximately 75% discount on the buffet if you earn the points that day and redeem them. 75% off is something the highest tier players get every day anyway, but now all players can get this discount. At videopoker.com, this month's monthly prize will be Multi-Strike. Multi-Strike itself isn't a videopoker.com game, but 5-Play Multi-Strike is, which combines Multi-Strike and 5-Play. I'm assuming it will be in the 5-Play version. Multi-Strike is a 4-line game where you play all 4 lines at once, which means 20 coins on a single line version and 100 coins on a 5-Play Multi-Strike version. You play the bottom line first. If you end up with nothing on that line, the game is over. If you end up with any kind of win, including just getting your money back, you advance to the second line and all your pays on that line are doubled. If you win anything on that line, then you advance to the third line and all wins are quadrupled. And if you win there, you advance to the fourth line where all wins are multiplied by 8. You can also get a free ride at random, which advances you to the next level without having to win anything. Correct strategy on each line changes. Video Poker for Winners is the only software that includes this game and various strategies for each line. At videopoker.com, you can play for free, and the contest is open from the 23rd to the end of the month. First prize is $500. All right, with the rest of the show, I would like to talk about my 10 commandments of gambling. And I think Munch led into a lot of areas of ethics in gambling, and I'm going to touch on some of the same kinds of things. My 10 commandments of gambling is one of the most visited pages on my website, and something that I often get asked about when I'm interviewed, whether on television or radio.
The first commandment is appropriately, thou shalt not cheat. There should be no explanation to that. And Munch talked a lot about cheating in his interview. And this is something that really bothers me, is when players cheat each other, such as in skimming a team. I can't explain why it's wrong. It's just you just know it's wrong or you don't. I think that we're not just living this life to maximize our own happiness, but I think that there is a connection between all of us. And Munch talked about the loneliness in professional gambling and how he would rather make less money but do it with other people. And I think that most people are social creatures like that. And I think when you cheat another human being, it brings down not just you, but is a sad commentary on the whole human race. So I would like to see a lot more honesty, not just in gambling, but everywhere. Second commandment, thou shalt honor thy gambling debts. A true gentleman honors his debts, especially gambling debts. When making a bet with another person, you are putting your honor on the line. If you lose, you pay, no excuses. And this is another thing I feel very strongly about. I can't count the number of times I've won a bet and the loser welched on paying me. It just really bothers me, and I feel that I got cheated, so really it goes back to the first commandment about honesty. And by the way, I don't think I'm going to have enough time to get through all of these, but I will get through as many as I can. Now, this next one is more directed to recreational gamblers, and I know this is supposed to be a show about advantage gambling, but humor me anyway. The third one is thou shalt expect to lose. The Las Vegas Strip was not built by winners. Even with good rules and strategy, the odds are still usually in the casino's favor. So if you lose, don't get mad. Expect it, because that's what was likely to happen in the first place. Think of gambling as the price you're paying for the entertainment. So to recreational gamblers, I always say, do so in moderation, do it with entertainment money, don't take it too seriously. Bet enough to have fun with it, but not more than that. Number four, thou shalt trust the odds, not hunches. If you want to maximize your odds, then believe in mathematically proven strategies, not hunches. If hunches are so great, then why are there so many psychics working the boardwalk in Atlantic City as opposed to going into the casino and playing in them? And this doesn't just refer to hunches like, I bet the next roll of the dice in craps is going to be a seven. No, it can also go to people that think that they're using something that's mathematically based, like the latest betting system, but it's not. You have to know what's mathematically sound, and there are plenty of charlatans out there selling strategies that claim that they're endorsed by mathematicians and physicists and throw out a lot of words like chaos and string theory and quantum gravity and try to impress you. It's all a bunch of crap, if I can say that on the air, and I feel very strongly about that. So don't trust everybody when it comes to gambling advice. Look at their credentials. Number five, thou shalt not overbet thy bankroll. Before you gamble, determine what you can safely afford to gamble with as entertainment money and stick to that. And I know I touched on this before, but that's something that I believe that for recreational gamblers, keep it under control and don't bet too much, just enough to have fun with it. Number six, thou shalt not believe in betting systems. For every one legitimate gambling writer, there are 100 charlatans trying to sell worthless betting systems, promising an easy way to beat casinos. I know it sounds like a cliche, but if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And I'm sorry for getting back to this, but there's a lot of overlap in these commandments. And one of the things I try very hard to do on my website is to discredit these people that are selling so-called easy ways to beat the casino. I'm sorry, there aren't any. If you want to beat the casino, you can, but it's tough, and you're probably only going to have a thin advantage. Anyone saying, buy my pamphlet on beat the craps out of craps, or here's how to make millions in roulette, or here's how to tell which hot slot machine is hot and which is cold, you know, these are all people that are trying to scam your money. And it's not just gambling. People do it in other ways as well. So have a good degree of healthy skepticism, please. Number 7, thou shalt not hedge thy bets. Hedge bets usually carry a high house edge. For example, never take insurance in blackjack and never take the any craps or the any 7 bet in craps. Exceptions can be made for insuring life-changing amounts of money. This one is something that I see all the time. Like a player gets a blackjack or a 20 in blackjack, and they take the insurance wanting to lock in a win. No, if you're playing in the casino and you're a recreational gambler, you're playing there to gamble. So gamble. For example, you have a blackjack and the dealer's showing an ace and they offer even money. Probably 97 players out of 100 take it. And it's a bad decision because you can make out better something like 1.05 times your original bet if you refuse it on average. So don't be afraid to take a chance. You've already walked through the doors of the casino and sat down. You're obviously okay with gambling, so gamble. Don't take these hedge bets, which only bring down your expected return most of the time. Now, before I didn't have that exception about life-changing amounts of money on my list, and people always wrote to me and said, well, you know, what if it's this bizarre situation and you're in a tournament? You know, yes, sometimes in life, you have to take a bad bet for the sake of the utility of money. For example, if you're on Who Wants to Be, Deal or No Deal, and let's say there's a penny suitcase left and one with $1 million, and the banker's offer is $490,000. Personally, I'd take the banker offer, and unless you just have millions and millions of dollars, I think you should too, even though it has a lower expected value. Number 8, thou shalt covet good rules. Rules vary from casino to casino. To improve your odds, know good rules from bad, and then seek out the best rules possible. This especially applies in video poker and blackjack. Video poker, you got your pay table right there. You know, why would you play, say, 7-5 jacks or better when there's a 9-6 machine, perhaps even in the same casino? It definitely pays, especially if you gamble a lot, to do your homework, know the good rules, know what they're worth, and then go out and look for them. Number 9, thou shalt not make side bets. Side bets are sucker bets. Most of the new table games and even the old classics usually will have at least one side bet. Leave them alone. I know players love them, and that's why the casinos love them too, but with rare exceptions, they're lousy bets, and I recommend staying away from them. And lots of times the dealers will criticize you, saying, oh no, this is where the big money is. Trust me, in the long run, you'll make better by avoiding them. Finally, thou shalt have good gambling etiquette. Gambling is a lot more fun when everyone is polite and respect each other, and it is also good etiquette to tip. And this is some place where I disagree with a lot of other writers, but I do believe in tipping appropriately for the same reason I would tip a waitress in a restaurant. And, you know, good manner. There are things in life that are more important than winning money, and good ethics is much more important than that. And I also think that just having good etiquette at the table is important too. So there, I managed to get through all of them as well. So let's talk about some future guests on the show. I'm hoping to get a dealer friend of mine on the show, and who knows what else September will bring. Thank you very much. Go out and hit lots of royals, everybody.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel Casino and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.